Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
It's just gone 5:42, and our next focus is Syria. The Syrian transitional government that is led by President Ahmed al-Sharaa has now announced a controversial plan to integrate approximately 3,500 former foreign jihadist fighters into its national army. Now, the United States has tacitly approved the move. It says, provided that the integration process remains transparent. Syrian officials argue that this strategy aims to stabilize the country and prevent further radicalization, but the decision has raised concerns among international observers. And with me on the line to discuss this further is Mansour Askar, a former Israeli Special Forces officer and a member of the Israeli Druze community. Mansour, it's always good to chat with you. Firstly, the United States says it approves this, or at least tacitly approves it, provided the integration process remains transparent. Do you think it's going to remain transparent? And what do you make of the potential risks of integrating former jihadist fighters into Syria's national army?
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, first of all. And regarding your question, we all hope that it's going to get better. You know, that's how we do it in Israel and in South Africa, in the West. We like to hope. But the problem is that all evidence on the ground are pointing otherwise. And it looks like, you know, the United States is again being fooled by the jihadists and convinced to pay the money to actually persecute the minorities. Now, when you look at these foreign fighters that are in Syria, they are one of the biggest jihadist problems that they have. They're the ones that were inciting most of the persecutions and the killings. It's the no man land. It's the Mad Max land of, you know, of the Arab jihadists. They go there, they loot, they murder, they take slaves, and they move from another place to another place. And many of them came from ISIS and from Daesh, and now they're officially putting them in the army. So which person on earth will think that this is a good idea? It's so dangerous, and it's so irresponsible, I would say. Let's take it a step back. When Jawlani was part of ISIS, he was given a command, an order from al-Baghdadi to go and conquer Syria. That was what he was told. Go and take over Syria. And what did he do? He did it. So you have a terrorist that went and took over Syria. And who did he use to take over Syria? These foreign fighters, along with jihadists that he brought with him from Al-Qaeda, from Daesh, from his adventures of doing Sharia law and jihad all over the globe, he brought them with him and he took over the government. So he is obliged to do what they want as well. So they're holding him kind of, you know, by the neck. And now the U.S. decided to remove sanctions and to tell them, okay, we're going to allow that to happen. It seems like a very irresponsible and dangerous move, if you ask me.
Mansour, I'm guessing here that what the Syrian government is thinking, that it's better to have these extremist elements under your control and part of the national army rather than have them on the fringes and outside of the framework. Why, if that's the thinking, do you think it's not going to work?
I think it's not going to work because the people in Syria have an inherited very racist problem in the community there. They don't want anyone who is not a Sunnah there. Now, you have right now, as we're speaking, there's about 6,000 Druze students who still are on the hide or with their, you know, went back home because they can't go to universities. If they go back, they're either going to get kidnapped or murdered. You have the Christians there living under permanent fear of being annihilated. And then you have all these jihadist forces there that are just waiting for the excuse to go and kill them and actually trying to go and kill them. So it's, you know, bringing them under the law, not in the law, giving them uniform or let them keep wearing their own uniform. It's not changing their belief. The problem there is fundamentally religious. And if you don't address that problem and start moving it towards, let's look at the Emirates. You know, they're still very Muslim. They're still religious. But they started moving forward and adapting science and the future. Mm-hmm. And the best cornerstone to see if a Muslim country is becoming better or not is the minorities. Many of my Jewish friends, when they go to Dubai, especially in the beginning, I was asking them, you know, because I'm an Arab. I can go speak the language. I feel safe, relatively. They're Jews. They have the accent and they don't know Arabic. And I asked them, how was it? And they told me, man, it was so safe. I felt so welcomed, so safe. That is the cornerstone of how you should be tested as a Muslim country. How do minorities feel under your rule? In Syria, they're on the verge of extinction. And at any given moment, they're trying to kill them and take their daughters as sex slaves. So I just don't think we should give them any money or remove any sanctions, to be honest.
Talking about minorities, what's the latest news you hear from Syria regarding the Druze community?
So the Druze there are still under siege. They have a lot of issues there with, they're not receiving any medical aid. They don't have any electricity in their villages. They can't leave. There was an ambulance that was trying to take six patients that had some kidney stones. And that ambulance was, you know, shot with an RPG or an IED and exploded, killing everyone in the ambulance. They don't have access to hospitals. They're in a very, very bad place. The only ones that are actually having good life right now, security and medicine and everything, are the ones that are that are under the Israeli control. Because Israel took over the Golan Heights in the Syrian part, and there's a few Druze villages there. Over there, they have hospitals, they have food, they have shelter. We're managing to bring them supplies because people are sending them a lot of supplies. But the problem is the majority of the Druze are in Sweda, and that is bordering with Jordan, but they're not giving them anything. And they're completely sieged around by Muslims who are still shelling them and trying to shoot them, and they can't leave. So the situation haven't changed at all. If anything, and here's a funny part, there is a leader, Al-Hajri, that's the Druze leader in Syria. I've talked to several Muslims from Syria that are telling me that if there was proper voting right now, they would have voted for him. Because he seems to be the only leader that is asking and demanding that Syria become a democracy that is fair for all of its citizens. And what happened is Syria has been ruled now by the radical jihadists. So even a Muslim moderate man in Syria or woman, he can't say, he can't speak. So right now, the only leader in Syria that is speaking sense is this guy. But what happened is the government in Syria is trying to portray him as a terrorist and as a bandit because he's refusing to give away the weapons. Now, obviously, the Druze are not going to give away their weapons when you're still trying and ongoing, trying to kidnap their daughters and kill their men. So I see it very closely. I have relatives there. The media is not talking about it. I mean, you guys are the only media company that is asking me questions about it. I'm not hearing anyone even giving a platform to hear it from real Syrians or from people that know the situation over there. It's not what it looks like. It's far from actually being okay.
Mansour, I want to go back to the point about the integration of former jihadist fighters into Syria's national army. How might this integration affect Israel's security calculus, particularly along its northern border with Syria?
That's a very good question. Right now, we just had a few mortars shot from Syria into Israel. And Israel sent basically a warning to Jawlani and to his people, if you don't take control of that, we're going to intervene. The people of Jawlani, the jihadists and the soldiers, they hate Israel. They keep saying, we want to march until Jerusalem. And they basically want to do the same thing that Hamas and Hezbollah did. It's a very, very ancient radical Muslim brotherhood jihadist move. Now, the only one that is standing as a buffer between them and Israel in some aspects is the Druze. And I feel that Israel understands that. That's why they also want to empower them, because there's a benefit that we get from that. Now, the army of Jawlani right now is not allowed to go south of Damascus for that exact reason, because Israel knows what these guys want. And they have way more soldiers than Hamas have, or even the Hezbollah. So we don't want a chance of suddenly 100,000 jihadists started running at our borders with RPGs and the help of China and Russia and Qatar and who knows what. So obviously integrating these jihadists into the military is not going to improve the morality standards or the ethical value of that military, because they're going to become officers. They're going to start teaching and training new soldiers, and they're going to lead by example. One of the most beautiful things that we had in the IDF is that every soldier was taught, every officer, that you must lead by example. That's why in the officer academy, there's the verse from Gideon that says, "Mimeni tiru v'chen tasu," look at me and do as I do. And that was the whole soul kind of heart of being an officer in the IDF, that you must lead by example. Now imagine what kind of an example are you going to have right now. You're going to have official ISIS terrorists in your ranks, officially.
I mean, it sounds crazy.
I think that answers itself. Yeah.
From a counterterrorism perspective, do you believe that integrating these fighters could lead to unintended consequences, such as the resurgence of extremist activities?
Oh, absolutely. The terrorists usually are very chaotic. They're very chaotic. They're very opportunist, and they don't form good soldiers when you look at it in terms of taking orders and I don't know what. Now you're going to give these terrorists, and also they're very corrupt, meaning that they will steal a lot of things from the army and they will give it to their families and give it to their friends. So basically now you gave these guys, and instead of needing to raid an army base and steal the equipment, they're just going to be in the army. So you're going to empower more and more terrorists. Now, some of the problems when it comes to Muslim soldiers or jihadists is that the line from being a moderate into becoming an extremist that want to go and suicide, kill himself, can happen in a day sometimes. It can go from 0 to 100 very fast. Now you're going to have these soldiers there. I'm not going to envy the officer that needs to command these guys that in a wimp of an eye can suddenly decide that they want to blow themselves up or I don't know what. It's not a good thing to have them in your army.
I can imagine. And you were talking about being an officer, leading by example. During your army days, when you were an officer and a member of the special forces, how did that shape you? How did it shape who you are today and your view of Jews and Israelis?
It shaped me. First of all, it taught me one of the most important lessons that I have until today, which is the power of education. I saw my role as not only here to teach my soldiers to become fierce warriors, but also to be better humans. Now, it makes you suddenly start realizing that every soldier that you have a mother, have a father, have a brother, have a sister, and also have one day a future family and a life. So you need to be very, very careful. What do you teach him? How do you teach him? And also be the example to lead for him. It's not only in the battlefield, it's later on. A lot of my friends in the army, including myself, were really impacted by good role models, men and women that were with us. So you're surrounded with that all around you, and that's kind of the vibe that is going there. But one of the most important things that I've learned actually during that time is how can I be a servant to my soldiers and not just be their commander? And how can I help them? How can I make their time easier? If I can go and relieve one of them from guard duties, I'm going to do that. And that was a very humbling experience because it's very easy. And that's something that you see a lot in the IDF. The best officers and usually the most elite units have the most humble and lack of ego kind of ego out there because you don't want cocky people or with ego. You want actually people that are willing to volunteer and serve. And it goes with you outside. Like I took it with me outside of the army. When I finished my service, I went and I helped a friend build an orphanage and I volunteered with street kids. And until today, I'm doing a lot of volunteer working. And that came from the army, from actually being a soldier and having an officer stand there and tell us very important thing. He says, whenever I ask for a volunteer, all of you should raise your hand. The first time he asked, actually, the only one that didn't raise his hand, he took him and he made him run
so
up the hill.
So there's a lesson.
Exactly. And then it is here we don't ask for volunteer. Any chance that you have that you can help, you volunteer and you jump. So when you take that with you to society, you end up coming as a better member of society that goes outside and says, okay, let's see how can I help my people. And you see that in Israel. You see that a lot in Israel. That's why you have so many people willing to help one another in Israel. And willing, even now, that's one of the only reasons that you have young people, the TikTok generation, that has been 600 days at war and still fighting and still there risking their life to bring back a hostage that most of them don't even know. In many countries, when I talk to young people, they'll say, oh, hell no, I'm not fighting for this government. I'm not fighting for this country. I'm not going to risk my life. You look at Israel, you still have a young generation and an old generation that is still willing to go out of the comfort zone, voluntarily, you might say, and go and risk their life to save others.
Mansour Askar, we need to leave it there, but it's always such a pleasure chatting with you, a former Israeli Special Forces member and also a member of the Druze community. Thank you, as always, for giving us insight and your thoughts and opinions on what's happening. We appreciate it.